cup of coffee?
She said. It was a nice cafe, friendly and cheap, and it cost Miss Minton some effort not to allow the professor to buy her a dish of chicken and rice.
I lunch here most days, he said, since my wife died. Was that a long time ago? Yes, 10 years now. I blame myself. The climate didn't suit her. I should have taken her back to England.
Miss Minton frowned. She did not approve of people blaming themselves for what was done.
Are the caves difficult to reach? The ones where your slough came from?
She asked.
Yes, difficult, but not impossible.
Did Taverner think there were more remains there, more bones?
He thought there might be, but that's neither here nor there. I shall be 58 next year, an old man.
That is the kind of remark I don't enjoy, said Miss Minton cuttingly, and picked up her coffee cup. When she came back from the museum, Maya found the twins in an even worse mood than usual.
What are those supposed to be?
Sneered Beatrice, turning over Maya's drawings. I can't make a head or tail of them.
I know, Maya sighed, but birds are really difficult to draw. Well, why do you have to go and show off in the museum then? I suppose you want everyone to say how clever you are. And you've got a mosquito bite on your forehead, said Gwendolyn. It looks like the kind that goes septic. You've probably caught lice too on that Indian boat. You better not come near.
Maya said nothing and went to her room. She had stopped wondering what she had done to annoy them. But to tell the truth, the poor twins had just learnt something which upset them very much, and they had learnt it from their mother.
We don't like Maya, Mummy, the twins had said. She's a prig. The way she goes on practicing the piano when she doesn't have to. And she flirts with the boys at dancing class and shows off the whole time. And she's conceited about her hair, the way she brushes it and brushes it. And she sneaks off to talk to the servants.
Mrs. Carter sighed.
I know you don't like her, she said.
We hate her, said Beatrice. When is she going away again?
Wailed Gwendolyn.
Oh, don't,
cried Mrs. Carter, caught off her guard.
Don't ever mention her going away. If Maya goes, we are undone.
The twins stared at her, their small round mouths hung open. Mrs. Carter tried to pull herself together.
No, it's not as bad as that. But your father, there have been difficulties with the price of rubber, and so on. Maya's allowance from her guardian is absolutely necessary to pay the bills.
You mean she's staying forever and ever, said Beatrice. Just because she's rich and we're poor, it isn't fair.
Now, please, girls, I'm sure your father will find a way round, and when he does, he can send her away. But just for now, please try to be nicer to Maya.
The twins shot her a furious look from under their pale eyelashes.
We'll have to think of something, said Beatrice when they were alone again. We certainly will, said Gwendolyn. But if we get rid of her, we won't be able to have any new clothes. Unless we can get hold of the reward for the Taverner boy. If we get that, we won't need to see Maya ever again, said Beatrice gloatingly. I still think she knows something. I'm going to watch her day and night. I'm going to watch her too.
When she had first seen Finn's hut and the lagoon, Maya thought it must be the nicest place in the whole world. Clovis did not think that at all. He liked being inside the hut, especially at meal times, but he found the surrounding jungle most alarming. The anteater lumbering down to drink like a grey tank, sent Clovis rushing back indoors, and the chattering of the monkeys in the trees kept him awake at night. Finn made him help with all the chores. Clovis had to keep the hut clean, scrub out the saucepans, and help get the Arabella ready for her journey. Clovis liked the hummingbirds. He learnt to refill their bottles of sugar water, and he didn't mind painting the boat. He was used to painting scenery, but cleaning the villages and burying the kitchen waste was not to his taste at all. But if Clovis wasn't very good at rough work, he was absolutely first class at learning his lines. Every morning and every afternoon he sat down with the old red notebook in which Finn had written down all that his father had told him about Westwood, and when Finn tested him, he found Clovis word perfect.
"There isn't very much," Finn had told him at the beginning, "because my father never talked about Westwood, if he could help it. And remember, they won't expect you to know anything. They'll probably think you've been brought up a savage. All the time, if you're going to stay for a week or two without being found, it might help you to know a little."
So Clovis sat by the table in the hut, twisting a curl round his finger, and studied the notebook, and every hour or two, Finn came and tested him.
"What does the front of the house look like?"
"It was built by Sir John Vanbrugh. There are two wings, an east wing and a west wing, and in the middle is a block with six stone columns where the main rooms are."
"What about the statues?"
"There's a statue of Hercules strangling a snake in front of the west wing, and a statue of St. George spearing a dragon in front of the east wing."
"Now go to the front door. Think of yourself as coming back to where your father grew up. Think of yourself as Bernard Taverner's son," said Finn,
and had to turn his face away as he remembered how good it had been really to be his father's son and how much he missed him.
"You go into a great hall, which is always cold, with stone flags and a big oak chest into which Dudley shut your father for a whole night when he was 3 years old."
Clovis broke off.
"Dudley is dead, isn't he?"
"Of course he's dead," said Finn impatiently.
"That's what all the fuss is about. Go on, go upstairs. There's a long gallery with a knight's armour, very tall, which used to shine in the dark. Once Dudley got in and made it raise its arm, and a housemaid fainted. And there's a picture of a taverner, ancestor, who went to the crusade with the head of a Turk impaled on his lance."
Clovis sighed. Westwood did not sound cosy.
"What about Joan?" Finn went on. "Remember, she's your Aunt Joan, really. Where was her room?"
"On the next floor, overlooking the stables. The walls were completely covered with rosettes she'd won for riding. Red ones and yellow ones and blue ones. And she had a fox's tail with dried blood on it, nailed above her bed. Only it isn't called a tail, it's called a brush."
"And what was her nickname?"
"The Basher, because she bashed people." He looked anxiously at Finn.
"But she isn't there now, is she? You promised."
"No, of course not. She's married to a man called Smith and has four daughters." But he could see that Clovis was looking far from happy, so he flicked over the pages of the notebook to find the few things at Westwood which Bernard had liked.
"What about the bluebell wood?"
"It's on the far side of the lake, not where Joan held his head under the water. On a slope down to the river, there was a pair of woodpeckers nesting there and a badger set."
"And the garden?"
"There was a walled kitchen garden, and the gardener was nice. He used to let your father pick strawberries, but he had a stammer, and Dudley used to imitate him, and..."
"Never mind Dudley," said Finn quickly. "He's dead. What about the other servants?"
"Well, the butler was called Young, but he wasn't young, he was old, with liver spots on his hands, and everyone was scared of him. He got a maid sacked for reading the books in the library and the one that helped your father."
"And the dining room?"
Clovis rattled through every detail of the dining room. It always cheered him up thinking of English food and English meals. But as often as he felt brave and forward-looking, Clovis felt scared and told Finn he couldn't do it. "I wish Maya could come," he kept saying, which annoyed Finn. Finn wished it too. Till Maya came, they would not know what had happened in the museum and whether their plan would work. But when she did come, the next day, they saw her by her face that all was well. To get away from the Carters, Maya had needed to work hard at her pulmonary spasms. She had had a spasm at breakfast, wheezing and twitching, and another one in the drawing room when she was doing her embroidery. They were good spasms, she thought, but it wasn't till the third one, just before tea, that Mrs. Carter said icily that if her lungs were giving her so much trouble, she had better go out. Since it was raining, the heavy dark rain that fell so often in the afternoons, she thought Maya might refuse, but she was out of the house in minutes, and Fuhrer, thank heaven, was in his hut and ready to take her to Finn. This time, the dog greeted her as a friend, placing his cold nose in her hand, and the happiness she always felt when she came to this place rose up in her. "It's all settled," she said. "The professor was wonderful. He showed me everything, and I stole the keys," she added proudly. "At least, I think I did, though he did tell me where they were, so that may not be proper stealing." She handed them to Finn, hoping for praise, but he had obviously expected her to do what he had asked. "Good. The trapdoor may be difficult to lift. We'd better take some oil. Is it still under the slough?"
"Yes, and the professor is still worried about the missing rib. How's Clovis?"
"He's washing his hair. He's always washing it," said Finn gloomily. "I thought you might cut it for him."
"I've never cut anyone's hair before."
"There's always a first time."
Clovis came out of the hut, then, with a towel round his head and very pleased to see Maya.
"She's done it," said Finn. "The hiding place is set up. She's got the keys. The boat goes at dawn on Saturday, so on Friday we'll get you settled there. We'll need blankets, a lamp, some food. I'm going to let everyone think it's me hiding there, even the Indians. That will make it safer. I'll tell them that the crows have heard about the lagoon."
But Clovis was looking definitely green.
"How long do I have to be in the cellar?" he asked fearfully. "Not even a whole night. The crows are due back on Friday afternoon. They'll come looking for you almost straight away. You'll see it will work."
"Clovis, this is the best thing, honestly," said Maya. "The Goodleys have been turned back at the border. They've been locked up until they can sell their assets and clear their debts. They think you're staying with me, so they won't bother about you anymore."
"I suppose I could stay here," said Clovis doubtfully, looking round the hut. "No, you couldn't," said Finn. "I won't be here. I told you, I'm setting off in the Arabella."
He turned to Maya.
"Come and see her," he said. "You've done quite a bit to her."
Maya followed him onto the launch. The rain had stopped. Finn had painted the floorboards and mended the awning.
"She's almost ready," he said.
"Are you sure you can sail her alone, with having to get wood and everything?"
"Yes, I couldn't take you anyway," he said, reading her like a book. "I don't even know exactly where I'm going, and you're a..."
"Don't say it," said Maya angrily. "Don't you dare say I'm a girl."
Finn shrugged. "All right, I won't, but it could be dangerous and I won't involve other people."
He looked back at the hut where Clovis was toweling his hair.
"He's absolutely hopeless at the chores, but he's amazing at memorising things. I reckon he knows everything about Westwood already. We did Sir Aubrey this morning. His eyes, his whiskers, and actor's training is not to be sneezed at."
Then,
"How long have you got?"
"Long enough to help you polish the funnel," said Maya, and took a cloth.